We're in our second half of the month. We're going to talk about this parami of resolve. And these paramis, they're called paramis, that's the Pali term for them, but really they're thought of as 10 perfections. So if you think about it, you can think of it as there are 10 kind of practices that the more perfected we get at those practices, the stronger our capacity for being free, the stronger our capacity for being liberated. Or more and more I think of it as the stronger my ability to put up with whatever happens, to be able to deal with life without getting completely knocked off center and losing my capacity for kindness or compassion. So this perfection is resolve, this perfecting this idea of resolve. And so I wasn't here, but the first 2 weeks of the month we talked about resolve, like the nature of resolve. What is resolve, or what would be the components or the way that you could begin to contemplate about what resolve is? And that it's not really this granite kind of way of gritting our teeth and putting up and pushing through with anything. It's something much softer than that, something much more movable and bendable. But it's in our right intention. It's in our intention to live out of these tenets of our practice, which is to practice renunciation, this freedom from ill will, and to this harmlessness. So those tenets that we have, those greater kind of boundaries around us, resolve is that ability or that willingness to return and return and return to that, to those tenets or those boundaries. So then to this week and next week, we're going to talk about how I think a practice would look like, how it would look like, what kind of practicing we could do in order to make that happen, in order to get in touch with our resolve. So kind of like what I think about it is, we're actually, this seems like this is the perfection that's telling us you're going over the deep edge here. You're going into the nature of our basic human tendency and conditioned behavior, our habits and obsessions and samsara. I mean, because in order for us to even think about practicing resolve, and we think about practicing resolve in practicing around renunciation, not causing any harm, kind of dealing with that ill will, the nature of doing that is in the midst of our constant conditioning, our constant habits, samsara. Samsara is a Pali word that means this kind of cyclical way that we just keep doing the same thing over and over and over, even though we keep saying, I'm not going to do that anymore, we keep doing the same things over and over and over, no matter how destructive these things are, no matter how much suffering that comes into our lives about it, we just keep doing it over and over and over. So in thinking about practicing with resolve, you're basically stepping into the midst of that. So I think this talk, on one hand, it's probably going to seem like some of the quotes I was looking at. I mean, Pema Chodron is most of the people I'm going to quote tonight, and she knows a lot about resolve, but it comes from a lot of mess, just constantly living with it and being in practice with it. But it's so liberating when you think about what's possible if you do this. So I want to start us out to keep us in a perspective that we can hold this with, that Matthew Ricard said, it's not the magnitude of the task that matters. It's the magnitude of our courage, which I think is so big. It's not the kind of courage that we need to go take on, you know, living around lions or, you know, Bengal tigers or any of that. Lions, tigers, bears. It's not that. It's more like the kind of courage you need if you're like a kid on the first day of school. So school's getting ready to start. And if anybody has any kids, or if you know anything about kids, this is probably the best period. Because they're bored with summer and they're tired of not having anything to do. So there's all this excitement to start another year of school. And so there's that both fear about going into a new grade. I don't even know if this is going to be hard or if I can do it, or think about going from elementary school to middle school, things like that. But then there's an excitement at the same time, a curiosity, an interest in doing this. It's the kind of courage you need to have a baby. Right about now, in today's society, you know, there's a part of you that's totally excited because you're getting ready to have a baby and they're so cute and special. And then you're scared to death. Like, what kind of world are we bringing this baby into? So there's a bit of courage there. But we don't always think of this as courage. Going into a marriage, it would be courage. Starting a new job that you're so glad you got it, but you're starting a new job. You don't have a clue what it's going to be like. It's that kind of courage that I think is connected to resolve. And so it's keeping that kind of idea that it takes a little courage to do this as the backdrop of the talk as we go along. Because some of it, you know, we're going to have to delve into some of this stuff about ourselves that we don't like. And I think probably the first thing you have to start with, if you're going to talk about resolve, is right view. There's a sutta. It's called wrongfulness. But basically it says, a person in wrong view, wrong resolve comes into being. In a person of wrong resolve, wrong speech comes into being. In a person of wrong speech, wrong action. In a person of wrong action, wrong livelihood. A person of wrong livelihood, wrong effort, goes through all of the Eightfold Path. And then it says, this is how from wrongness comes failure, not success. From rightness comes success, not failure. And this is how that comes into being. In a person of right view, right resolve comes into being. In a person of right resolve, right speech, and so on and so on and so on. So basically, what this tells me is that how we are looking at a particular situation that's in front of us, how our perception, what our view is about the situation, makes all the difference in the world. Because if we're looking at this situation or some moment in time, some experience we're having, if we're looking at it from the wrong view, then all of our efforts are going to send us down a path of just more suffering, more difficulty, more challenges, and getting us further from this greater freedom or this greater sense of capacity that we could have. If, however, we are looking at a situation, no matter what it is, some moment in time, from right view, then all of our efforts, our resolve, all of our energy that points us in the right direction will ultimately cause us to live a kinder life, a life that's connected to our practice of renunciation, freedom from ill will and this harmlessness. It starts, though, with our view. So another way you could think about this wrong view, this view is like a GPS or a compass. Whatever that, you know, how many of us have followed the GPS on Google? And then all of a sudden you're like somewhere you're not even supposed to be. It's not even near. I mean, my brother's house is somehow wrong on the GPS. It lives way out there like Bonnie Lake somewhere. That used to be like way away. You didn't, nobody lived out there. Now it's like commonplace. But to get to his house, if you don't figure out how to get there and you just try to use the navigation tools, they send you somewhere nowhere related to his house. So if the navigation tool is a little skewed, you're going to end up in the wrong place. It's the same way with wrong view and right view. So I don't really want to go into this a lot, but one of the main kind of tenets that you would just think about in view, like how would I line up my view, is to begin to pay attention to the what I would call the four distortions of mind. Thinking that something is permanent when it's not permanent. You think it's permanent. You think it's going to last forever, but it's not. It's impermanent. Everything is always moving, shifting, adjusting. Or we think something is going to satisfy us, something that is inherently unreliable. It's not going to satisfy us, but we expect it to do. And then when it doesn't, we get unhappy. Or the thing that we think is going to be permanent, it ends. Something goes askew. Who knows? Something happens. And now we're upset because what we thought was going to be permanent is not. Or we think the world should be beautiful, lovely, it should be pleasing to us, and it's not. And lastly, we take things personal. We think that the world is personally applied to us, and it's not. And so those four kind of distortions is what I use to help me kind of square up my view. And so that's what I'm going to talk about, how to practice with that. How do we practice with that, looking at these distortions? I guess one way to think about it is we could use those four distortions as a way to see or become aware of what's getting in the way of our ability to actually let go of something, or what's behind that ill will or that harm that we're causing to ourselves or someone else. We could see the distortions as a way of sort of preventing us from practicing, preventing us from coming back to our practice. Or we could think of it as a way of seeing or becoming aware of its presence, that distortion's presence. And let me see if I can. But ultimately, whatever we do, it boils down to we practice in this moment. So I think I have a quote from Ajahn Chah that might hint at what I'm saying here. So if you want to understand suffering, you must look into the situation at hand. So you have to be right there. You have to look right here in this moment. The teachings say that wherever a problem arises, it must be settled right there. Where suffering lies is right where non-suffering will arise. It ceases at the place where it arises. If suffering arises, you must contemplate it right there. You don't have to run away, and you should settle the issue right there. He gets a little difficult here for me, but He says, one who runs away from suffering out of fear is the most foolish of person of all. He will simply increase his stupidity endlessly. That's all John Shaw's words, not mine. But it's beginning to see, I mean, it's kind of a harsh way to say it, but it's sort of the point. If you're in wrong view, meaning you're trying to get away from that difficulty, you're trying to make this difficulty go away and make it better, you can see that your resolve to make that difficulty go away and get somewhere better, that resolve is just going to lead you down a path that is going to get increasingly more foolish, more difficult. Because the idea of pushing away the things that cause us difficulty and problems, the kind of making our unhappiness go away so that we can be happy, that's where the problem comes in. That's where the difficulty comes in. So our resolve starts with this view that I'm going to stay right here with whatever this is. The practice of resolve, is another way to think of it, is not a long-term practice. It's just right here, right now. It takes 2 seconds to be right here, right now. Very short window. Even though, over the long haul, you keep coming back to this very short window, and then you can look back in future times and see, oh, I see that my resolve, this continuously coming back to the present moment, actually supported me and created this increase in liberation. So basically, we want to use this, use our resolve or use the four distortions to help us see if we can pay attention or we can practice around renunciation. Freedom from ill will and harmlessness. So let's start with renunciation and how would we kind of apply it. Thanissar Bhikkhu, he's one of the, you know, scholarly monks that I listen to. I read these articles that him and Bhikkhu Bodhi write on Access to Insight, the website. Oh my God, it's such a treasure trove. I can't believe it. But he wrote this article called Trading Candy for Gold. And this is probably one of the best articles I've read on renunciation. And so Tim did a whole thing on renunciation. I'm not going to really go through a lot of it. But he calls the practice of renunciation a willingness to make intelligent sacrifices. And what he calls an intelligent sacrifice is any sacrifice in which you gain a greater happiness by letting go of a lesser one. And I like the way he explains this because the example he gives is if you have a bag of candy, and this intelligent sacrifice is the willingness to give up the bag of candy for a pound of gold in exchange. Because he says the problem is we want to keep that candy and get the gold. That's our problem. We don't want to let go of the candy in order to get the gold. We want the gold. And it seems like a relatively simple thing. Why would anybody keep candy instead of gold? Of course I'd exchange candy for gold. But actually what we want is to keep the candy but get the gold at the same time. So he says, the more mature you get in your practice, the more you can begin to see that we don't get everything we want. And so whenever we indulge in one sort of pleasure, we begin to recognize that that necessarily means we are letting go of another. That ability to begin to discern what greater freedom am I letting go of? To indulge in this sort of pleasure in the moment's time. So what he suggests in this article is that we prioritize the mind. Prioritize paying attention to the thinking mind and what's going on in the mind. Another quote by Ajahn Chah is, Dhamma is in the mind. Dhamma is in the mind, not in the forest. So don't believe others. Just listen to your mind. You don't have to go anywhere else. Wisdom is in yourself. Just like a sweet, ripe mango is already there, present in a young green one. So our wisdom, our understanding, our Dhamma, our practice, our right view isn't going to come, unfortunately, from listening to Dhamma talks. It's not going to come from that. It's going to come from, in a moment's time, when you're feeling some twinge about something in that moment, wherever that tension has risen, and for whatever reason, you could begin to see the distortion. You could begin to see how much attachment you are putting on something the minute you begin to feel some issue around it. You can see that you're trying to hold on to something that is not permanent, simply because its natural capacity for changing and shifting is going to automatically create the tension in you. There's no way away from it once you put an expectation of permanency around it. There's no way to not get frustrated when we expect our car to start and we go out, put the key in there, and it doesn't start. It's in the distortion that we have that we expect that it's going to start all the time, that it's always going to start, or that it's going to satisfy our need for travel simply because I bought this car. Now I don't have to worry about traveling anymore. I got the new car. In fact, I bought a new car to make sure I don't have to worry about it. And then you put the key in it and it doesn't start. So that fact that the mind has that expectation that things are going to satisfy us, that is the whole point of helping us see that these are distortions, they're not actually true. Resolve, then, is the willingness to step into that tension when it's there and investigate, like, with the same level of courage, excitement, interest, investigate what is it that's happening here? What's going on? Where's this tension? Why is that there? It's not because the car won't start. And it's not because something didn't go the way I wanted it to go. That's what we think. We want both the things to go the way we want it to go and get this liberated mind and get enlightened and all that good stuff. But we have to give something up. And what we have to give up is things going our way, things happening the way we want it. And instead, step into that discomfort. Another way you could think of this in relation to renunciation is you could think of the things that you do daily, the things that you do, the things that you have, the stuff you have, the things you use, try not using it. Try not doing the things that you do every day. Try to interrupt that habit. Because I mean, some of us, I can just think back when I was in practicing and working all the time, I really had my day, because you get up in the morning, you do this routine, you go to work, come home, everything is so set that the idea of disrupting the day it was the people in my world that disrupted my day, but I had everything set perfectly going smoothly. I walked to work the same way. I did everything exactly the same way. A little maybe OCD about that. But it was the people that would come in that would be the problem. So in order for me to begin to see how much attachment I had towards things being and being a certain way or certain things satisfying or fixing going right, I would have to disrupt things. So in some respects, you can just disrupt your day on purpose, just to see what it's like if you get up in the morning running late and then think, I'm not going to take my car. I'm going to pretend that my car doesn't work. But I'm not going to take my car. And see what happens if you had to figure out, how do I catch the bus to work? How do I get to work if my car didn't work? It's things like that. Your ability, the practice of resolve, is not to make things better, but to come back to these tenets and these practices when things aren't working. So the way Sharon Salzberg says this, I think, is she says, it's never too late to turn on the light. Your ability to break an unhealthy habit or turn off an old tape doesn't depend on how long it's been running. A shift in perspective doesn't depend on how long you've held on to the old view. When you flip the switch in the attic, it doesn't matter whether it's been dark for 10 minutes, 10 years, or 10 decades. The light still illuminates the room and banishes the murkiness, letting you see the things you couldn't see before. So it's never too late to take a moment to look. And basically, that's what resolve, when you're thinking about practicing with resolve, that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to find those places that you're trying to almost like disrupt things a bit here. Disrupt things that are going smoothly so that you can see where these distortions of minds exist. And in some respects, if your life is going along at a good clip, chugging along all nicely, there's some distortions going on there. And as soon as something goes awry, you can feel that getting upsetness. Which moves us into this more freedom of ill will, freedom from this ill will. It's like, to me, it's basically practicing metta. But we're practicing metta so we can kind of live out of this more universal kindness, friendliness. Universal kindness, not to some people, to everybody. That's kind of a hard thing, even the thought of it. When I was typing it, I thought, yeah, that's going to be difficult. But not to some people, to every people. Not when we're feeling good, but always. So whether we feel good or we don't feel good, could we act out of this much more greater universal kindness? And to do that, we need to get up close and comfortable with ill will. We need to get to know what ill will feels like. And much of our practice around resolve in relation to freedom from ill will would come at getting close with the times in our lives when we're not too happy, when we're irritated and upset. These are some Pema Chodron quotes. I got about three of them here to help us with this, because this is probably the hardest part. To me, practicing resolve around our renunciation, letting go of some of our attachments and things, that we can kind of look at our habits. But practicing resolve around seeing our irritations, our ickiness, our meanness, this is a much harder place to practice resolve, this willingness to come back. So that's why I picked these Pema Chodron quotes to kind of help us through it. So she starts with this notion that difficult things provoke all your irritations and bring your habitual patterns to the surface. And that becomes the moment of truth. You have the choice to launch into your lousy habitual patterns or to stay with the rawness and discomfort of the situation and let it transform you. That willingness to stay with the rawness and discomfort of a situation is what resolve is all about in that moment right there, that practice. In some respects, I notice in my own life, I don't know about you guys, but since I'm assuming we're all practicing at the same level here, what I notice is I have this great willingness to be kindness when I know, to be kind, when I know something that irritates me is about to be resolved. Then all of a sudden, when I think I'm going to get my way, then I can get much kinder. Or after the thing that I was so irritated with kind of resolves itself, then I can think, oh yes, I'm going to try to be more kind next time. But in the moment that I realize I'm not going to get my way or something's not going to happen the way I want it to happen, right then and there, it's raw and discomforting. That's where resolve is. It's right there. That's what Ajahn Chah is speaking to. Right there is where practice is. So what Pema Chodron says is, the next time you lose heart, or you can't bear to experience what you're feeling, you might recall this instruction. Change the way you see it and lean into it. Instead of blaming our discomfort on outer circumstances or our own weakness, we can choose to stay present and awake to our experience, not rejecting it, not grasping it, not buying the stories that we relentlessly tell ourselves. This is priceless advice that addresses the true cause of suffering, yours, mine, and that of all living beings. So basically what she's saying is, no matter how difficult this feels or how unpleasant this seems, the moment some difficulty arises, some irritation, some meanness, something, if at all possible, do not let it resolve into pleasure. Do not let it get fixed. Stay right there in that discomfort and resolve to come back to just a feeling of that, to being with this. And can I re-look at this to see why am I having difficulty? I used to tell myself over and over and over and over again, whenever something unpleasant happened to me, I would say, it's not that. It's something in you. It's not that. Whatever it is, it's not this. It's something in you. What is happening in me? That ability to constantly come back and check yourself, it means you're going to see some ill will. You're going to begin to feel some of that unpleasantness. So what Pema Chodron says is, although it's embarrassing and painful, it is very healthy. It is very healing, and healthy, to stop hiding from yourself. It is healing to know all the ways that you're sneaky, all the ways that you hide out, all the ways that you shut down, deny, close off, criticize people, all your weird little ways. You can know all of that with some sense of humor and kindness, but by knowing yourself, you're coming to know humanness, togetherness. By knowing yourself, you're coming to know humanness altogether. We are all up against these things. We are all in this together. It doesn't speak to some You're not speaking to some bad thing about you simply because you're taking the time to step in and lean in to some difficulty, some anger, some, it's all of the stuff we don't like, the shame, the resentment, the bitterness, all of that stuff that we don't want to believe. And so you can think with me, if you think like I do, as soon as I notice that bitterness, as soon as I notice that little gut check, what I want to do is get rid of that. I just don't want to feel that bitterness. I don't want to, it seems anti-Buddhist if I'm too bitchy. So I'm trying to clean it all up and get all nice and smooth, happy and smiley. And doing that, constantly going that way, is what Ajahn Chah is talking about. It's foolishness. Because every time we turn away from that bitterness, guess what's happening? That bitterness is coming right back around to us. It's going to show up in a couple more hours. Tomorrow, it'll be right back there because it is a conditioning. It is a habit. It is a continual, habitual mind state, and it keeps coming around. So if instead, when I feel that truth of that bitterness, that irritation, that resentment, whatever that is for us, if instead we turn towards it and say, okay, what is this exactly? It keeps coming around. I keep finding myself irritated or bitter or resentful all the time. What is that? And turn into it. Lean into it. Feel into that displeasure. From that place, the cessation of that bitterness or the suffering connected to it, that's where that suffering, that's where that cessation rises, in our leaning into the bitterness. Not when we somehow push it away, find some little happiness, and now we're all okay. It's true, we feel much better, but we just gave up a pound of gold for a bag of candy. We can't keep that candy. We can't keep that. Everything is going to be nice and I'm going to have good pleasure. So the last thing Pema says is, stay with that shakiness. To stay with a broken heart. So to stay with that shakiness, to stay with a broken heart, with a rumbling stomach, with the feeling of hopelessness and wanting to get revenge, that is the path of true awakening. Sticking with that uncertainty, getting the knack of relaxing in the midst of chaos, learning not to panic, this is the spiritual path. That's what we're doing with our resolve, leaning into some of these difficulties. And then finally, in doing that, we can begin to touch into this harmlessness. We can begin to practice by paying attention to what the thinking mind is actually saying. We can get comfortable and up close with harm, the harm we're causing ourselves and the harm we're causing other people. The more we can get comfortable with this harm, the feeling of harm, we'll know it. In fact, when I first started practicing, 25 years ago, to be truthful with you, I did not care very much about other people. I did not care about, I think I told you guys this, I didn't care if my behavior was affecting someone else. It's not that I meant to be mean, but I didn't pay attention to that harm because I never felt it. I never felt the pain that anyone else would experience because of my behavior. I didn't feel any of that. I could feel my own pain, and I could do whatever I needed to do to make that go away. But I couldn't actually feel someone else's pain. But over the course of practice, the subtleness of feeling harm is an important thing to begin to feel, because the more you can feel harm, the more subtle we get at being able to feel it. And I can feel the slightest shift of harm. I can feel it in other people. I can feel it in myself. I can feel it all around me. I can feel that pain everywhere. That compassion begins to show up because I lean into suffering all the time. And the thing about it is, it's hard to know this unless you are willing to turn and lean into suffering. That compassion is this incredibly freeing experience around suffering. So usually from the mind's perspective, if there's some harm, some difficulty, some pain, that has got to go and we got to feel better. That's it. If I don't feel better, something's wrong. We have to make that go away. But actually, when you start practicing in the resolve to stay with that harm, to stay with that difficulty, what you find is this more expansive quality of compassion shows up and helps you hold that difficulty long enough to see its cessation. So we're looking into it. I want to say one more thing before I end. Joseph said something. I was at this teacher training retreat, and Joseph Goldstein said something. It completely, sometimes Joseph can just throw these little things out, and he just throws it out, and he's gone on, and you're like, wait. Something happened here. Wait a minute. He was making the statement, and he said that his practice changed when he realized that emptiness was love, that the emptiness and metta was the same thing. So I heard that, and I registered. Everybody in the room was like, oh, that's so insightful. So then he's going along, and then he says, you know, this is just during the course of the retreat. He took the statement that he said at the beginning, and he began to unfold it throughout this whole retreat. So in the very beginning of the retreat, it's when he said his practice changed when he saw that emptiness was the same as love. And then a little bit further into it, he says, well, you know, emptiness is the wisdom, and love is what happens. You know, it's sort of, love is our response to emptiness. So the more empty we are, empty meaning the less caught we are around our opinions and our judgments and our pre-expectations, assumptions, and values that we put on things, the more open we are to letting everything just be as it is, the natural response is going to be love. That's the way we're going to start acting. The more we are willing to do the resolve to turn inward and look at the assumptions and judgments we're putting on life, putting on people and things. And then as the retreat went on a little bit further, this is towards the end of the retreat, I think it was probably the last full day we had. He said that I asked this question. I said, well, why do we teach metta? Metta is so important. Why do we only teach it like at the 2 o'clock sit in the, you know, like after lunch, you're sleepy, and now we're going to do the loving everybody? And why can't we do metta like more often, all the time. If it's the same as emptiness, why don't we do it all the time? And he said that we do metta all the time. We only teach it as emptiness because we won't hear love. We have all this problem with the word love, kindness, sweet, gentleness. So we talk about it in terms of emptiness, but it's all the same thing. Because for some reason, if we think we're getting empty, wiser, we think, oh, I can stay on the breath and I'm becoming a better person. We do that. Because if we did a retreat and we talked about love the whole time, everybody would be like me. I'm not going to the metta retreat. I'll go to the wisdom retreat, but I'm not doing that metta retreat. But in reality, that's all we're teaching, is love and kindness. Is that not like mind-blowing? He just sort of brought it out over the course of the week. So basically, everything we're doing here is to help us be friendly, kinder, softer, more tender with all these difficulties that come up in our lives, because these difficulties are always going to come up in our lives. It is the nature of being human. So, I'll leave you with this quote from Pema Chodron. Nothing ever goes away until it has taught us what we need to know. So let's just take a moment. Okay, so thank you for your kind attention. See if there's any questions or comments anybody has. Oh, yes, ma'am.
As you know, last year, I lost my brother. The Vietnam War finally killed my brother. Everybody here probably knows that. I'm not having any problems hanging on to suffering. My daughter died a week and a half ago. I practice the Brahman Hatha. I do metta for myself. I do metta for Christine, wherever she is.
So the question is, if I put it like this, just tell me if this kind of gets it. So you have this great suffering from your brother's death and your daughter's death, and it's right there up close and personal. And you practice this metta, you're practicing this metta, but the suffering is like just right there. So how do you give yourself more compassion? Is that the question?
Or anything.
So one way I think you could think of this is, and I'll use this in comparison with my mother's death. The death of someone that we love, we can't get away from that. Because that is the nature of life. Everybody in this room is going to lose somebody very close to them. Everybody in this room is going to experience that pain of death, because that pain of death is part of being human. It's the nature of attachment. connected to that death, my mother's death, was some distortions around that, right? Because one, I couldn't accept that she died. She died out of the blue. So I had all this attachment around her not dying. It took a while for me to begin to let go of the idea that it was somehow wrong, unfair, not right that she should die. And instead, to just give myself permission to just be with the sadness. She was gone. And this knowing that even that sadness is not going to stay. That over time, I can remember people telling me when I went back to work, oh, you'll get over it. And it was like, I probably took off almost a month. It was so difficult for me. And then when I went back to work, people would say, oh, in time, you'll get over it. And I used to think, no, I won't. It's not going to get better. But it did. It just takes its own time. The point is not to get so caught in the ruminating over the distortions, which is, I wish this didn't happen. Why did this happen to me? It shouldn't have happened. I used to have all these thoughts, like it shouldn't have been my mom. It should have been someone else's mom. In fact, the mind can get so crazy. I was so mad that I had grown older because somehow I thought that if I were younger, she would still be here. Who knows where the mind comes up with these things? The practice is more to begin to notice those distortions that are taking you away from just letting the pain of that moment be there and let it pass on. That the grief just comes. It's the story that we add to it of not wanting to let go. That's the adding. All that add-on is what's causing us so much suffering. And so it's just the resolve to let go of the stories, the add-ons, and just be with this uncomfortableness until at some point it ceases. Good. Anyone else? Mm-hmm.
For me right now is I'm practicing with seeing it is the idea of I can't really make mistakes and I there is really nothing I can do that is imperfect, yet I have a belief that says I have to write it in such and such way that it will be complete and therefore finished and perfect, or that, and then a mistake, like I identify what a mistake is. And yet what I'm hearing and what I do see opening up for me is, that only exists in a story in my mind. And when I let myself, I want to ask about how to open up more to that, so I can, put it on voice or whatever I need to do, because I know I'm looking right at that
right
now.
So the comments that she's looking at, this notion that I can't make mistakes, that the idea that I can't make mistakes, that's what's giving you the most amount of difficulty. So this is constantly trying to make everything perfect so it doesn't show up as a mistake. And inevitably, it's going to be a mistake on the page. The thing is, you can work with this from my perspective two ways. One is, I think the way Pema Chodron's talking about it is in the moment that you feel that tension, that you're trying to get it right, the idea that it's going to be right is the bag of candy. Like I can actually get this right. Just wait a minute here and I can get it right. And then I'm going to be happy and everybody's going to like me because they're going to say, look, you did it right. It's great. That's the bag of candy, that we will not let go of that just to feel this unnecessary adding on tension of trying to get it right. So in the midst of your constant rewriting and fixing and reading and trying to make sure it says the right thing, can you just stop and feel into that displeasure, the fear that it might not be right? Let go of the thoughts and the story around it and just feel it. Because basically with the resolve to come to not doing any harm, you know, liberating ourselves from this ill will and this renunciating, coming back to that kind of practice, ultimately what I think happens is our, when we're just still with it, the wisdom of all our practice rises up and says, it'll be okay. It'll be okay, right? It rises up, but we don't give that wisdom time to rise up. We don't get the bag of gold because we keep thinking that if I get it right, then it's gonna be okay. So we feel the tension and we don't like it, but we're leaning into this idea that it really is gonna be resolved and it's gonna be okay. And what you wanna do is, in the midst of that feeling, that tension, shift your attitude from, I really have to get it right, to what is all this tension about here, and seeing if you could just stay with that. Or another way to do the same practice is just to, in the midst of your sitting, bring that concept of, I have to get it right, I have to get something right. Just bring it to mind. You're gonna let go of the concept and just feel what's happening in the body, and let that feeling in the body be your object of meditation, whatever's coming up, because you bring that concept into mind. What if I don't get it right? What if I don't get anything right anymore? What happens in the body then? It gets all freaked out, and you try to let that feeling be the object of your meditation. It really is not the mental resolution to these things that we call problems, but the felt sense of what is these things that we call problems. That's where we're going to find the wisdom is going to rise in that. See? Good. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then it piles on and piles on. And I guess you're saying it's driven by a fear that I'm not sure how to break into that, how to stop that process.
Well, let me, so the comment is, it's similar to the previous comment in that whenever something happens, there's all this piling on of negative thinking, negative thinking, negative thinking. And the question is, how do you break into that negative thinking? So the way I want to answer this is to show you what I did with anxiety. Because anxiety, I would panic and have all these, this crazy thinking that would go on. And the best way to try to describe it is that because the body and the mind are so symbiotically related, that the mind's thinking process, which is the conditioned mind and the habitual nature of it, that mind is not trying, it does not care how much pain you are feeling in that moment. That anxiety is not concerned with me thinking I'm gonna die. It is just drumming and drumming and drumming and drumming and drumming. And I am trying to get rid of the anxiety in my mind. So can you see the difficulty here? I'm trying to get rid of the anxiety by making it stop. And the more I try to make it stop, the more the mind and the body thinks, we got something going on here. It's working. And it's like all alive. So I keep trying to make it stop, and the mind keeps generating it. It's like a whole conversation going on. It would not stop. The one thing I did not want to do was feel the felt sense of anxiety. What I wanted is the bag of candy. Can I figure out how to make this anxiety go away? And if I could just figure that out, then I can tell myself something and it'll go away. But the pound of gold is actually the felt sense of anxiety. Where is this in the body? What is this feeling? And not any thoughts about it, just a felt sense of it. It's very uncomfortable and it's very difficult to feel. So you have to do it in little chunks, but you feel it without words. It's, remember that brilliant discussion night we had with Tim on truthfulness, and he said, we did that dyad, I think it was in dyads, and he said, the question was, what is true outside of thought? And trying to speak into what was true outside of thought was almost impossible. It was so brilliant. So in some respects, that's what you want to do. You want to know what's true about this felt sense here without all the thinking and the story connected to it. Then what is it? Because what ends up happening that completely catches us off guard is that once we get comfortable with the felt sense of something like anxiety, it loses its sting. It gets boring. It becomes a felt sense like you've been sitting on these chairs and cushions the whole time and you doesn't even think about it. You don't even think about it. You're just sitting there. It's like one of the things. It's just some felt sense. And when you begin to feel the felt sense of anxiety without this urgency to get rid of it, the aversion of it, it's got to go. I can't have these negative thoughts. I need to do something about this. I don't like it. Okay, let me apply some metta, and that will make it go away. Right? It doesn't go away. You got to be with it. You got to turn towards it, shift your attitude, have this sense of I'm going to lean in and feel this felt sense. No more, I'm not worrying about the stories. Just want to know what's true in this moment, in this felt sense. What's true without all the storyline? And what you find over time is that all that panic, drama, anxiety about to come out of my skin, I'm gonna die, goes away. It's not that I don't have anxiety. I still do, but it doesn't have any sting. It doesn't have any oomph to it anymore. It's just this little sensation that arises and then it passes away. That's what you're trying to get to, but you won't be able to get there through the mind. That's like trying to hold on to the bag of candy and get the gold too. You can't have them both. So we're gonna have to let go of the thinking about it, trying to resolve it in the mind, and just feel that unpleasantness. Good. Well, we probably should leave it there. And then we have some announcements.